Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Last week we talked with Montana Wilderness Association veteran John Gatchell about the history of wilderness legislation and attempts to designate wilderness in Montana. It was full of surprises, ranging from what I will call top-down Forest Service management to bottoms-up grassroots hunters and fishermen and labor unions working with the conservation community to get wilderness designations, and then sort of the wild card of Congress, who was in the delegation, could they reach agreement? When they did, we got wilderness. When they didn't, it died. We're continuing that discussion today. It's good to have you back, John.
Thank you.
So we were talking about unions that represented mill workers and loggers in the period of the 90s coming together for recommendations, correct?
That's right. Recommendations for Congress called the Kootenai and Lolo Accords.
Okay. Any examples of the interaction between the politicians and the grassroots people that come to mind?
Well, after the hearings were held, and then Senator Burns came to a meeting in the Montana Wilderness Association in Missoula spontaneously. We didn't know he was coming. When the mill workers were there, and so we quickly gathered around him in a room, and he had been the obstacle to considering the Kootenai-Lolo Accords.
Where was that coming from? Philosophy, industry?
Well, you know, and this is familiar. Whenever you want to attack a collaboration, you say, well, who wasn't involved? You start focusing on, because you can never involve everybody in the, in the known universe. And so we had been going through his list of, we need to talk to different interests. We talked to mining companies. We continued to do outreach. But at this point, we were able to meet with the senator directly, and there was tremendous power. Hmm. I remember Jerry Slingsby, the president of the union, was there. The president of the union from Libby was there, Smoke Elser. And there was tremendous power in having the timber workers talk to the senator directly. And as he came up with each reason why he wasn't going to consider it, they dismantled those reasons until he finally agreed that he would consider it in that meeting.
And what happened?
Well, you know, we walked out of that room, and I thought it was important to get that in the on the public record. So he came down to the convention, and I talked to a television crew and said, Senator Burns has just agreed to consider the Kootenai-Lolo Accords. And so when he walked out of the room, there was the microphone and the television camera, so we got it on the record. And I think that helped break the logjam. We still had problems and obstacles and debate.
And it did eventually not pass. Is that correct?
Much of it was in the Senate bill that did pass in March 92 with the support of Senator Burns and Senator Baucus.
We've neglected part of the story, which is yours. When did you formally go to work for the Wilderness Association?
Well, I applied for the job of conservation director in 85 and was eventually given the job.
How many staff were with them at the time?
I was the only full-time staff person, and there was a part-time administrative assistant, Susan Bryan.
And had you been involved informally on some of these issues on their behalf before you applied for the paid job?
Yeah, as a volunteer, I was president of the local chapter in the Flathead, and I was also active in an alliance called the Bob Marshall Alliance, working to protect the Swan Range and Rocky Mountain Front.
Why did you apply for the job?
I was working in construction at the time, and if I wasn't camping or in the outdoors, I was writing letters or working on it, and it just became my passion. It just was something I wanted to do more than anything on earth.
Okay, you apply for a job, the only job, to whom?
To the state governing council. They were all volunteers. The state council is elected by the membership, and they were the governing council.
And the membership in Montana now is about what?
It's about 5,000.
And was it about 5,000 then? Do you even
remember? It was significantly smaller.
I see. So as conservation director, newly hired, your job is what?
My job is to work with people around the state to help encourage them so they could be effective advocates for wild places around Montana to keep them wild.
I think today, which is, let's say, 30 years later, the image of wilderness advocates is sort of urban, upscale, perhaps yuppie, in contrast with blue-collar hunters and anglers. Before I ask you to comment on the stereotype, what was it then? What was the stereotype then? Who were your members? Who were you trying to organize? What kind of people?
Well, all kinds of people, from school teachers in Shoto, Gene Sense, to we worked with hunters from Butte, like Al Lubeck and Chris Marchand from Anaconda. Mm-hmm. They in turn eventually worked quite effectively with the Big Hole Ranchers, Jack Hershey, Clayton Huntley. Jack's dead now, but the Hershey Ranch is legendary in the Big Hole. And they worked in common because they didn't want to see it. The Forest Service in the 1980s planned to build 2,000 miles of new roads into the Big Hole. And the ranchers, as they came to understand that, eventually made common cause with sportsmen from Butte. And that
why would ranchers not want more roads?
Well, it introduces weeds, it introduces problems, and it's changing the Big Hole, which is really an iconic agriculture, public land landscape.
And in your 30 years with the association, has the nature of wilderness advocates changed? I gave a stereotype of more urban-based, backpacking-type folks. Mountain bikers, maybe. I don't know. What would you say?
I think the nature it's constantly changing, but I wouldn't say it's limited to urban people. I think there's greater, when you lack wilderness, then you understand instantly its value when you experience it. Mm-hmm. But I think, wildness is disappearing from the country all over the place. So I don't think it's limited to people in urban areas. I think it's something that's in common. I don't think it's a partisan issue. I think hunting and fishing in Montana continue to be some of the primary reasons that people go into wild places. And so the hunting and fishing community is really essential. The wilderness movement in Montana was really born in the hunter's campfire. People like Ken and Florence Baldwin that started the Montana Wilderness Association were avid hunters. And I think backcountry hunters continue to be a very, very important part of the support for wilderness across Montana.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with John Gatchell, more than 30-year veteran of the efforts for wilderness designation in Montana. Now, there has emerged a group of people, motorized use, snowmobiles and ATVs, that have played an active role in opposition to wilderness. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And when did that start to happen, and how did it play out?
I think it started to happen decades ago, but it became stronger when the machines, when they marketed much more powerful machines that could penetrate. In the past, the machines couldn't really get deep into wild country, and by the 1990s, ATVs and snowmobiles were capable of going anywhere. Mm-hmm. They created all-terrain vehicles, so a lot of the conflict that resulted in the 90s and the erosion of wild country came about basically because more capable off-road vehicles were going in. They were ATVs, for example, were traveling on single track trails. They were widening them into roads.
Okay, but somebody might say the same thing that happened with the loggers in those early meetings could have happened with those folks saying, we think there's room for both, we would like both, but I'm hearing that the dynamic was different. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. We did end up negotiating a series of winter recreation agreements with snowmobilers. Let's see, 2000 in Sealy Lake, 2001 in the Flathead, 2004 in the Little Belts and Big Snowies, 2005 in Lincoln. Those were negotiated with local snowmobile clubs that did help and identify the fact that there was room for both snowmobiling and wild places.
Okay, you were in some of those meetings?
Yeah, I participated in all of those.
All right, so compare the meetings, the tenor, the tone, the knowledge of landscape in the early meetings with what you experienced in these meetings with snowmobilers.
Well, I think that in the beginning there was tension in those meetings, and you know, we were deliberative. We were not interested in hurrying. Sometimes we brought in biologists to talk about wolverine, mountain goats, and other species that can be affected by winter recreation if there are no limits to it. And we used the Forest Service as a resource, but we conducted the meetings. And we have instituted basically all the plans that we have recommended. 2013, the Lincoln Plan was finally implemented, and that was the last one of our agreements.
And how about the tenor of the meetings? In other words, were they, I'm used to public hearings where people shout their positions and there's not really dialogue. Was there much of that then? Because there was this promotion of an idea that said, I'll call it the analog of the jobs versus wilderness. It's us or them. They're going to take our rights to ATVs, or they're going to take our wilderness, which was a position fanned in the political environment. So was that reflected in the tone of the meetings or not?
No, our meetings were very respectful, deliberately so. And once we reached an agreement, we had a period to review that agreement. Again, there's no hurry. You don't want to have a hurried. Mm-hmm. And sometimes refining that agreement and then signing that agreement so that we were committed to a mutual. And once you reach an agreement, the map becomes essentially a partnership. So at that point, as we did with the mill workers, we become united in a common cause. We're no longer just advocating for the portions that we want as wilderness or the snowmobilers want as snow. We want that map to become the Forest Service's map. But we have to convince the Forest Service. So there's still a process because we don't represent everyone when we collaborate like that. So we understand that the Forest Service has an obligation to take something like that to the broader public for review.
So, okay, so let me just jump in. We have two-step, actually a three-step. One, the grassroots dialogue leads to a recommendation, has to be approved by the Forest Service. Your sense over that 30-plus year period when you've been involved in these things, say close to 40 before you became staff, what is the Forest Service's, the nature of their response compared with 30, 40 years ago?
I think the Forest Service today is a very different agency. I think their response, leadership is still spotty, I think, but I think more people in the Forest Service are recognizing that they can foster collaboration, that collaboration from outside the agency can be an important way of resolving conflicts that are difficult for the agency to tackle.
Do you run into the idea of X official or Y official saying, look, I'm trained at this. I spent 6 years of college at this. My colleagues and I know what we're talking about. Who are we to take the advice of a bunch of local yokels that just happen to live here and have very narrow prejudices?
I would say, by and large, that's changed a lot. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't involve and engage the Forest Service or utilize their expertise. We do, and it's a mistake not to.
Okay, let's look at the other one, the political front. In the past, you've had difficulties, I'll say, getting, to some extent, you've had successes and failures getting our political federal leaders, senators and congressmen, to support grassroots recommendations. How's that changed in the 30 years? What are we facing?
Well, you know, I think what we've seen happen in the last 10 years particularly is a blossoming of local community-driven collaboratives that have looked at landscapes and come up with landscape proposals like the Blackfoot Clearwater Partnership, the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Partnership on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge Forest. We see the Whitefish Range Partnership that reached an agreement and made recommendations on how the entire Whitefish Range on the Flathead National Forest on the British Columbia border should be managed. And this fall, the Kootenai stakeholders in Libby have forwarded recommendations. And all of those recommendations include a spectrum of management, just as our lands have a different nature, from wilderness to areas that are suitable for logging and for fuel reduction projects, with restoration projects and recreation elements.
Okay, so that's just saying in my terms, and I've been involved in some of those discussions, that perhaps the recommendations from the grassroots groups are somewhat different, maybe more sophisticated or complex than they used to be. My question was, what's the response of the politicians, the congressional delegation? Has that changed?
It depends on which members of the delegation. Senator Tester has been supportive of collaboration and introduced legislation to enact, and we're greatly appreciative of that.
Let me just jump in there. Forest Jobs and Recreation Act, we had him on the show to discuss it. It's been something like 8 years. It has not passed Congress.
Yeah, it came within a whisker of, and all but passed in 2011, as I'm sure he explained to you.
That suggests what to you? In other words, is it partisanship we're talking about, more partisanship than we used to see? What's going on at that level?
Well, I think it's larger than the issues we're dealing with, which is that I think there is greater partisanship, and I think there's more emphasis on money and campaigning, and that means less governance. And this is a situation where if the Montana delegation sits down and applies the same kind of cooperative spirit of people working together that you see in Sealy Lake, in Libby, in Whitefish, and in other areas, that's what we need from the delegation. But that's been lacking. And so their response has been, of some members of the delegation, has been, well, you know, we're not interested in moving a package that includes wilderness or includes conservation elements. And that means that they're not, then you no longer have a package that's balanced.
Okay, well, where does that come from? That's their opinion. They're articulating it. They're elected by the people. Where are they getting that impression? Because it seems to be contrary to a long history that, frankly, prior to this program, I was not familiar with. And I like to think that I am somewhat familiar with the history of conservation the last 25 years in Montana, but I was ignorant about it. Are they uninformed, or is it a matter of campaign support coming from XYZ constituency that says part of the deal for our support is no wilderness? What's your assessment?
I think that would be a better question to ask the members of the delegation, but we need them to step up in the same kind of spirit and move these collaborative elements forward. And I have to say that that's not happening right now.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with John Gatchell, who has 30 years of work with the Montana Wilderness Association on the development of proposals for designated wilderness that have succeeded and failed over time, depending upon circumstances that we're discussing now. I had recent experience with an example. I don't remember who told me, but it was verified by a member of Senator Dane's staff, that in one case of a collaborative proposal, Senator Dane's and his staff said, have you included in the conversations Carrie White, who is a state representative? Now, I had personal experience with Carrie White only one time when I approached him at a function. He was not a member of the legislature. He was a leader of a motorized group at the time. And I said, somebody told me that it's your position that your group should never to participate in collaborative discussions. And he said to me, that's absolutely true. We're against it. We always lose. Now, as a result, if he's held to his position, he does not participate in collaborative discussions on behalf of his motorized folks. And when I heard about it, I said to the representative, the senator, to require the participation of someone who's against collaboration and refuses to participate as a condition of support of the collaborative is fundamentally dysfunctional. And if the senator is not aware that the guy is anti-collaboration, and he may be right in his position, I'm not arguing that, but it's like asking for the impossible. You could make the same argument on the other side. There are people on the environmental side who refuse to participate in collaboratives. They consider them sellouts. They typically or commonly litigate. It would be like saying, you have to involve those people in the collaborative before we'll consider the results. How often are you running into this? How big an obstacle does it pose?
I think it's a large obstacle, and I think it's a way of saying that we're not interested in carrying community-based collaborative solutions forward if you rely on someone who has never been participated and will not support those kind of solutions.
Any thoughts of where it's coming from? Is it new? Is it just a more extreme expression of the partisanship that we talked about appearing at some point in the 90s? What's going on?
I'm not sure where it comes from. I think, you know, that there's more and more emphasis on campaigning and raising money for campaigns, an enormous amount of money. And I think that that has a really negative influence. So Congress spends more time fundraising, more time campaigning, and less time governing. And this is about good governance. This is what we need in Montana to break the gridlock, to move forward for stewardship, not only of areas that should be treated for fuel reduction near communities, but also to be good stewards of our wild country in the higher mountains.
One implication might be that the money that is more and more relied on is setting down some very specific conditions. Has that occurred to you as a possibility?
It's occurred to me, and it's possible, and it's impossible for me to say what exactly is influencing certain members of our delegation to prevent them from moving forward with collaboration. And we're still hopeful they will, but it's disappointing that they haven't at this stage.
My recollection may be flawed. I think it was Congressman Zinke, but again, I might be mistaken, who said including wilderness in some of these bills, timber reform bills. This recent bill, we did a show with the former Chief Bosworth about the fire budgeting, that there is a broader group in Congress, not just restricted in Montana, that has an agenda. And so even if the argument goes, even if Montana's delegation agreed, there are these polarizing and, in fact, partisan interests that make the passage of legislation impossible at a national level.
I think it's not impossible. Senator Simpson passed the Boulder White Clouds bill very recently, and so I think it just takes stronger leadership on the part of the delegation. How exactly they accomplish it is, you know, we rely on them to be the experts on how to work Congress, but I think to say that it's impossible isn't entirely true.
Let's take a look at another modern manifestation of difference of opinion. If you go back to the establishment of the Forest Service itself, there was opposition mainly by commodity interests who had benefited from basically free use of public lands.
That's right. It included people like Senator Clark, who was then a senator from Montana, but was a copper baron.
And then in the 80s, there was the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Pushing for what I will call divestiture of federal ownership to state and local government. As we speak, the wildlife refuge in Oregon has been seized by mainly, I gather, representatives of a ranching element of the ranching community that feels federal ownership of those lands is inappropriate. What's your take on that dynamic, that phenomenon? What are we seeing here?
Well, I think that dynamic is aimed at breaking up our public lands, which uniquely we own. We own our national forests as Americans. It's not like Crown land in Canada, which is owned by the Queen. It's actually owned by the people of America. And there's an attempt here to break that down, which would eventually lead to privatization and loss of national forests, loss of our public lands. And I think that that's at odds with our basic purposes. And it's not something we're going to agree on. At the same time, I think it's an incentive for us to want to move collaborative solutions forward so that we can be better stewards of those lands. I think for that, there's broad agreement.
Well, you say there's broad agreement. By that, there's broad agreement that the stewardship could be improved on federal lands. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's broad agreement that we could improve stewardship. I think the Forest Service wants to do it. There are funding problems. But there are, in fact, mainstream solutions, community-based proposals to move and improve stewardship that include everything from wilderness to logging.
Okay, how would you answer this? If I'm one of those guys on that refuge, I say, look, this is a huge bureaucracy that ultimately answers to Washington, to people who don't know about Eastern Oregon or Montana or this or that, the state doesn't matter. These lands would be better managed for the benefit of the people if they were managed by elements of government closer to the people, whether that's the state or the county, or even sold to private or leased to private owners.
Well, I don't think they would be better managed. I don't think there's any evidence that private lands are better managed. We have the example of Plum Creek and Champion in this state. Those were poorly managed lands and privately owned. But local entities can't necessarily afford the state, for example, the state of Montana does not manage lands like the top of the Swan Range or the Mission Mountains. They have no experience and they have no interest in this administration in taking over the management of some of the most rugged, remote mountain areas in the West. That's what we're talking about. That's where our public lands are concentrated. If we break them down and start disposing of our public lands, then that's inevitably going to lead to sales and no trespassing signs. Right now, we as Americans can travel on the National Wildlife Refuge, the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, the Helena National Forest. We can travel on our BLM lands. They're available to us.
You say we want to keep our public lands. Who's we and why?
Well, I think Westerners in particular, because we have more public lands than they do in the eastern states, benefit. Those are the places that we hunt and fish and camp, take our kids, and that's a huge part of the quality of life for people in small communities and large communities in the West.
You've been at this for 30-plus years, enjoyed successes and failures. How do you feel about it?
I feel great about having worked with people from around the state that love wild places, and I especially am encouraged by the fact that lots of young people are running the Montana Wilderness Association these days, and they're capable, dedicated, skilled, passionate, and they're going to accomplish things that I think we could only dream of 30 years ago.
John Gatchell, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for sharing with us your knowledge and wisdom of a critical part of our history. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week.
Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.